You're listening to Longwoods Radio, your healthcare source for ideas, new policies, and best practices. The following is a Breakfast with the Chiefs session on March 25th, 2008. Speaking is Dr. Michael Greer on the annual review of IM and IT in healthcare, the unvarnished version.
Thanks, Anton. I find myself in an unusual situation of being rather optimistic about IM and IT in Canada, which maybe will disappoint some of the people who come to hear me sort of complain and and thrash some of the players in the business. But there have been some great things happening in the past year, so I'll try to highlight a couple of them. And then the other piece that has been sort of, I guess, kind of creeping into consciousness is that there's some very disruptive things on the horizon in terms of the e-health space that are very likely to challenge our fundamental assumptions about how the EHR will work and how e-health will progress. So I want to take you through what some of those things are, and perhaps speculate on a little bit of their impact. But first, let's talk about some of the good news. So this isn't doing anything. There it is. So first of all, in case anybody had any doubt about how difficult what we're doing, I found this little piece which was interesting. The U.S. National Academy of Engineering, which has absolutely nothing to do with healthcare, listed the 14 grand challenges of engineering in the 21st century, and right up there with providing energy from nuclear fusion and reverse engineering the brain, advancing health informatics is on the list. This quote was particularly poignant for me. There's now consensus that a systematic approach to health informatics can greatly enhance the quality and efficiency of medical care and the response to widespread public health emergencies. So you can see that there's a pretty broad consensus that this is a huge undertaking. And as much as I'll try to sort of touch on this theme a couple of times during the talk, but as much as there's estimates of how much it'll cost to create the electronic health record in Canada, and you hear numbers like $7 billion or something like that thrown around, these numbers are very small estimates of what it will take to put together a comprehensive information infrastructure for healthcare. We're probably talking about spending in the order of 5% of total healthcare spending on an annual basis. I mean, that's the kind of numbers that one would expect from looking at other service industries who have a very heavy and very intensive information requirement. The $7 billion doesn't even fill 1 year's sort of cost. And I hope that we'll talk about some of the things beyond electronic health records in the sort of more traditional sense that still have to be addressed. So big news from just the last couple of months, Alberta Netcare and Capital Health Netcare in Edmonton have merged. These were both based on the same platform, and they've now pulled them together into a single platform. And in January, there were approximately 10,000 unique active users on the two systems, and that group has now been brought together. So I'm not sure about this because very few people sort of post their statistics about utilization of systems, but I suspect that this is the largest EHR in Canada at the moment. And about 30% of the active users are physicians. So the story here is an interesting one. Back in sort of spring of 2004, Edmonton, the Capital Health region, started their electronic health record project, and you can see here the ascendant sort of user numbers over time. And the province of Alberta, in its wisdom, realized that this platform was useful for the whole province, and so they contracted with Capital Health to start a provincial version, which was called Alberta Netcare. It was basically the same platform, and you can see the user numbers that have been growing on Capital Health Netcare, and then the two of them in January came together toward the end of the month. So this number, it will very likely be somewhere up here in February, but those statistics haven't been published yet. So you can see that there's been just tremendous growth in the number of users of this system. The story, and I've told this story before at part of these breakfasts, the story here is that they created a very content-rich environment and then continued to invest in it, working to get more and more users on board. And they've been very focused on their user community and what they've been doing with the system. And those continued investments, including investments from the province, building on that successful platform, have built now a very interesting community of people who are sharing this resource. I said that they keep very close tabs on what their users are looking at. This is one graph that shows some of the things that people are looking at on the system. This is 1 month's data from January. The degree of detail that they have on what people are looking at is phenomenal. So they'll know down to individuals at certain hospitals what screens they're looking at, how frequently they're looking at them, etc. That allows them then to compare what's happening in different hospitals and to be able to quickly tell that, gee, this hospital doesn't have a very good training program, or this hospital doesn't have a certain sort of content online that would be helpful. So if we bring that content online, we'll bring more users online. This is very much the kind of strategy. This is an internet website type of strategy for bringing more eyeballs to the page and using that kind of an approach to bring their users on board. The other interesting thing is that when you have an active user community and you're following this kind of information, the whole idea of a clinician focus group becomes obsolete. And this is one of the real challenges of starting a new IT program, is you pull together 20 or 30 clinicians and you get their best advice on what to do. But the fact is that advice is never actually that good. These people get 10,000 opinions on a monthly basis as to what's of value on their system, and then they can then follow those statistics. It's a much better way to understand what is of value. Just to highlight a couple of things, this is lab test results and transcribed reports. The PACS images is an interesting number at about 5,000. I just want you to remember that that's relatively small because I'm going to look at some Toronto information in a minute. And then the pharmacy information network, you can see that there's a very healthy utilization of that system. I've been critical of this project in the past as being one that wasn't very successful. And in fact, they've doggedly continued to get this working and useful to clinicians. And I think this shows that that they're having some good success. This is an important story as well, because we've had situations where, certainly in province of Ontario, where we've invested in systems that are not being used and haven't been very successful. And there's a tendency to quickly write these investments off as being a massive failure. And that's not smart. the game should be to bring in bring some users into the game, and as soon as the users start to drive the development and modification of these systems, you see some improvement in the use and utilization of that type of thing. So that's a great news story. Oh, I'm gonna do it too far. So what's the Toronto equivalent? Well, the closest we have is Patient Results Online, which is something that the SIMS group has been working on. You can see the organizations that are contributing to this and the organizations that are accessing this information. And this has also been a growing story over time. This is the unique users per month on the system up until the most recent month. Although this is showing the right trend line and is definitely good news, one would hope for another zero on each of these numbers in order to have anything close to rivaling the Edmonton situation. This highlights a couple of things that are important to know. First of all, it's a lot easier for Edmonton to pull something like this off, not because of oil money, by the way, but because because they have a single governance structure, and so they can have a single IT department, and there's no debates about standards or what technology or whether it's going to be .NET or WebSphere or what kind of platform it's going to be on. And so Edmonton's been able to move much more quickly. This is a tribute to a whole bunch of organizations that have voluntarily come together to start building this capability. The comment about oil money is an important one. People would die to know how little Edmonton spends and on their EHR agenda. They're being very careful about how they spend money and that sort of thing. And then the equivalent numbers for similar things in Toronto do add a zero on the end of the numbers. Like, it's a total order of magnitude difference in cost to mount these things in a situation where you've got very complex governance structures around the IT and a lot of different legacy systems to have to deal with. But such is the situation in Toronto, and when I see Matt came in, you were already introduced, Matt, before you arrived by Anton. And I think it's apropos, given this situation, that they put a CIO in charge of the Toronto Central Inn, a former CIO. So this is a big challenge yet to deal with. This thing is not very... there it goes. Okay, and the other point to make is that it's not just users, but it's the content that drives them to the site, and that, you know, adding new information to the platform not only causes more users to come to it, but causes the users that do come to it to use it more frequently. Now, this is similar information about the types of reports that are accessed on the system. So, again, I hope you're seeing sort of best practice in action here, looking at what the users are doing, how they're using it, and the frequency is critically important to managing these systems. Note that the imaging numbers are much higher in Toronto than they are in Edmonton as a proportion of the total. Lab tests still feature pretty highly. Transcribed notes are operative notes, procedure notes, progress notes, etc. are relatively smaller compared to the Edmonton situation. I don't really know why this is. I suspect that there's less of this content available on this system than exists in the Edmonton situation. But again, when you have these kinds of statistics, it gives you a great opportunity to try to ask, why is the utilization behavior different in the two situations? So when you start to get this kind of data, again, it speaks to issues of design and where we might want to invest funds to expand these systems. Now, before we get too optimistic, this is the National Physician Survey from 2007. And what it's showing, if you just look down here in the legend, it shows what the doctors respondents to the survey said was their primary record-keeping system, whether it was paper, combination of paper and electronic, or electronic only. And you can see for the Canadian situation, really a 10% uptake overall for totally electronic records. About 25% are using some form of electronic records. Woefully behind a whole series of European countries who have managed to get way ahead of the game on this. And you can see various provincial statistics here. Ontario very close to the national average. Alberta clearly in the lead on this front as well. I can't move on from this to make one other optimistic remark. I have to say that when I look at the Edmonton situation, one of the things that has been critically important in their success has been the ability of the province and some of the provider organizations to work together to accomplish things, and their sharing of funding and technology and sharing of the workload. And for the first time, I've seen that spirit of cooperation begin to flourish in Ontario. And I have to be very complimentary to what Gail Peach has been doing. She's been in the role in a short time, and she's done a couple of things that are critically important. One is that she's tied the e-health strategy to a clinical agenda around chronic disease and drug patient safety in prescriptions, which is a very welcome development. And the second piece is that she has been working, I think, very effectively with those players in the field who have a significant track record of success in this space. And I'm just delighted to see that this is, we seem to be updating our software on the fly here. I'm very optimistic that despite some of the challenges in Ontario with its complexity and diversity of systems, that Gail will be able to break through some of that and start to see some major success in the province. So, let's talk about some disruptive things that are happening. I was at the HIMSS conference in Orlando last month, and was interested in some of the new things that are coming on the scene. And I was reminded of this book by Clayton Christensen, which was published in 1997. So it's almost it's a little more than 10 years ago. It talked about a phenomenon of what he described as disruptive technologies. The key definition is the one at the bottom here. Technologies that begin with a weak product performance and have fringe features, usually new, that customers in smaller markets value. So let me try to explain this a little bit more clearly. This is a diagram that he uses from his book, and what he postulates is that for any market, there is sort of a performance range which the customer desires. They won't accept performance lower than a certain point, and they won't pay for performance above a certain point. So you could think of things like the amount of storage on your PC or on your iPod as a great example. People won't accept anything below a certain point, but there's a certain top end that, you know, how many songs can you actually put on one of these things? So there is a range. Now, a disruptive technology is a new technology that is unable to meet to fall somewhere in this zone. So it's below; it functions below the minimum performance. So so take for example a great example from the IT world was when flash memories were introduced. They didn't work very well, when you turned the power off, they lost their memory and that sort of thing. So they were used in small applications, in toys and stuff like that, and they really weren't very useful in a sort of computer setting. But what often happens is that they develop in a very different market that has a very different price point, and as they develop that technology and it improves over time, it starts to get to the point where it can start to compete at the bottom end of the of this sort of market curve. And over time, this product sort of invades and overtakes the existing product market. So other examples, take in the sort of software business, if you look at Microsoft's history, Microsoft has been very good at staying, being sort of the best in class in the Office market and in the operating system market, but they've had a number of things that have sort of been in the almost the toy space, okay, which have threatened to subsequently invade into their market. So a great example of that was the internet, which Bill Gates sort of missed the significance of the internet, and Internet Explorer, which now has become fundamentally part of the operating system of a machine. But Netscape was just such an invader, okay? And he and his company needed to spend untold billions of dollars to fight that off, and actually just take it over. And now we see Google doing a similar type of thing with their sort of distributed Office products. And again, the first time that these products come on the market, they're dismissed as being poorly, you know, not very functional, not very useful, and usually appeal to a market different from the primary market that the company has relied upon. But in that sort of relatively protected environment, it develops better functionality and features, and most importantly, a very low price point, which then gives it enough bulk to then invade into this larger market. So why am I talking about all of this stuff? There seem to be a number of e-health things that are happening at the moment that are very likely to completely overtake our current understanding of the electronic health record and the architectures that we've been playing with over the last 5 years. So while we hear that the EHR is going to take 5 years or it's going to take 10 years, and you hear all kinds of different predictions about it, in the way that we've conceived it at the moment, I suspect it will never happen, that it'll be completely overtaken by a different set of models. And so let me just throw out some things that are challenging that current model. Let me just finish up on the disruptive piece, just to add add a couple of points. I think I've touched on those. But this is an important point here, is that by the time the disruptive technology meets that minimum performance, the leading players aren't able to catch up and will ultimately lose positions of leadership. So again, some of the companies, I hear people say things like, oh, well, gee, we're going to buy Cerner and we're going to buy Epic because you can't go wrong with those companies. Like, they're the leading market share. And I think I said that to Jeff Lozon in the early 90s when I said WordPerfect has got to be the standard at St. Mike's. It's the leading market share. It has an unassailable position in the market. I learned the hard way on that one. So while we're talking about Microsoft, they launched their Amalga Hospital Information System at HIMSS. Now, you may not have heard much about this because they're focusing this on developing markets. It will not be marketed in North America or Europe. Complete electronic medical record. So it's got all the sort of clinical stuff as well as finance and some of the back office types of systems, all built on scalable Microsoft technology. So a very modular kind of architecture built on these more modern platforms. Now, I saw this being very interesting. I think they're probably marketing it in developing economies rather than in the G7 because the system would not meet the discerning sort of requirements of North American customers at this stage. The Cerners and the Epics probably have, and I don't know this, I'm speculating, probably have a much better user interface and a better developed environment. So they're going to sell to these other players. They're going to work in a much lower priced, a lower cost tolerant environment where the Cerners and the Epics can't compete because they're too high cost. Okay? So, but you look at the architecture of how this has been built, and the Cerners and the Epics of the world can only dream of having something like this. They've got this huge legacy sort of infrastructure behind them, which is the basis of their very rich functionality, but it's also the basis of a relatively slow and expensive response time in terms of development and re-architecting their platform as requirements evolve. So I'm simply asking a question as to whether this is an example of the beginning of a disruptive strategy for Microsoft to spend the next number of years developing this product to get it to a point where it meets the minimum requirements of the North American market and then bring it onshore. I have no clue if that's what they're doing. I just wonder if that's what the agenda is. The other thing to point out is that when you look at the very best players in the health informatics market and how much they're spending on research and development on their products, it's usually in the neighborhood of a couple of $100 million a year. There's not many companies that are able to mount an R&D effort that's much larger than that. Cerner, which is one of the largest companies, I think their annual revenues are about $2 billion. And I think their R&D budget is somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million a year. So that's sort of one of the leading players in the market, and they have a very good product. To a company like Google or Microsoft, $200 or $300 million a year is a very small number. So Microsoft decided it wanted to be in the gaming business, and it spent billions of dollars on their Xbox strategy to be able to tackle that particular market. Given that healthcare is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 15%, certainly 15, 16% of the GDP in the United States, that seems to me to be a very large market worthy of some investment to go after. When a company like Microsoft does something like this, you don't take it lightly in terms of their agenda. This company does not think small. So just let's next few years, I'll revisit this and we'll see what's happening. Now, I'll spend a few minutes talking about personal health records. Personal health records are exactly the type of disruptive technology idea that Christensen was talking about, because they're very much in their infancy, and most of them aren't very impressive, so they're very easy to dismiss. Most of them are in the kind of toys category, and sort of people playing with them at home on the internet. And it's all about facilitating an individual's access to personal health information. A report for the U.S. National Coordinator for Health Information Technology came to these observations that the market's relatively immature and lacks an obvious technological or market leader. In fact, there's a whole bunch of players in this space, and they're all using different approaches to try to tackle it. Very typical for a nascent, new sort of product. Everybody's jumping into it, and everybody's using different approaches to deal with it. And they can be standalone, they can be tied to other sources of health information, or they can be integrated with several sources of healthcare data. So let me just share with you some of the players in the space. Adam Guy is one of the engineers at Courtyard, put together this little diagram to explain this to me, and I thought it was useful to share with you. And he roughly grouped the different types of PHRs into three categories: tethered and to an organization, untethered and tied to a platform, some kind of a networked server, and untethered and tied to some kind of a portable technology, so you can carry your health information on a key or something like that. For this whole slide, this is sort of the direction of information flow. So you've got the PHR in this example tied to a healthcare payer or provider who wants to give the consumer access to some of their record information. That's a fairly simple one. So that'd be an example, would be like a hospital wanting their patients to be able to see their lab results or something of that nature. In this situation, you've got the healthcare provider over here. Okay, so the healthcare provider provides information either to the consumer or directly into the PHR through some kind of an interface. And the PHR is some third-party vendor. So it's some totally set. It's not the healthcare provider. It's some other organization that is acting as the host for that information. And then the healthcare provider can access this information with appropriate permissions. And the security and privacy approaches to this are all over the map. Again, there's no standards yet. The third type is very similar to this, except that the information is put on a portable medium, which then goes back to the healthcare provider. So these are just a few examples of organizations that are doing this. So the type one PHR, you can see the Department of Veterans Affairs has set up a website for their clients, and you can see it offers quite a bit. So benefits administration is a key element in the U.S. Context. A lot of their PHRs have something to do with managing your healthcare account. from a business perspective. You can see there's also prescription refills, chronic disease management tools, and then their agenda is to expand to looking at appointments, financial information, and parts of the medical record. Cleveland Clinic has been doing something they call MyChart, very similar types of functions. MyMedicare, which is the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, so this is really the government payer, setting this up for people to be able to look at their claims and their status, eligibility, et cetera, information on prescription drug plans, and that they can modify their drug list and pharmacy information. So there is some interaction with the patient here, and that they can order summary notes. So that's the type one. Type two, this is another place where Microsoft has waded in, as well as Google. They've both announced measures in the last year or so. And then this consortium, they call themselves DOSIA, of very large employers who are putting together a system for all of their employees. So very similar types of things. You can see medications, test results, history information. This is the interesting part. Practitioners will have to update this in order to maintain their preferred provider status. So you do it or you don't get paid. That's fairly strong incentive to participate. The Microsoft and Google pieces, I had a look at them at HIMSS, and they were distinctly unimpressive. And I think that's what makes them so interesting, is that they're very easy to dismiss initially. They're essentially stores where you can put information. And I say information as opposed to clinical information. They could really be any kind of information. And they have an API which allows developers to do all kinds of things with it. So it's very much a platform as opposed to an application sort of ready for use. It can be used right away, but it just shows there's no real user interface to speak of. It's kind of a list of documents and a list of results, which you can order sort of chronologically or alphabetically or that sort of thing. So it's, when I look at how much time has been spent over the last 20 years figuring out how to present clinical information to practitioners so that it's useful, it's presented in a useful way, and then I look at this, it's almost going back to a paper chart where there's a document, which is each page, that's sort of put together in the chart. But the fact that they've set this up in a way that allows other vendors to use the platform to add other things to it makes it a very interesting story. I suspect that many people will do the same thing that I did. They'll look at it and say, there's nothing here really, so I'm not going to worry about it. And again, these two companies don't have a reputation for doing frivolous things and then not following up on it. So very interesting to see how this will evolve. And then there's a couple of organizations that are doing things that are more sort of USB type, you know, put your health information on a USB, carry it in your pocket, and you can give it to any clinician. You know, as you can imagine, the challenge is getting this information from the provider organization to actually get it onto this platform. But this is a selection of three. There are many, many more of these, and especially in the type one category, you have a huge number of hospitals and organizations. I think Grand River, I think UHN, Sunnybrook, and I'm probably missing a number of others, have done elements of this already in the sort of tethered category. So, not sure where this is going exactly, but the potential to capture the baby boomers into the electronic health record business and to have them start to drive the way this develops is I think, a very compelling story. And when we look at our EHR architectures at the moment, in terms of how we're setting things up, this isn't really anywhere on the radar screen at all. And this may end up being the driving force for the whole space. I think I've covered that already. Let's move into another sort of disruptive place, and this is in the device manufacturers space. And more of medical devices are actually equipped with computer technology. This is something that the company Medtronic, which builds pacemakers and other implantable devices, has been pursuing for a couple of years. It's called the CareLink Network. And what they've done is they've equipped their pacemakers, their implantable defibrillators, and some of their other products with wireless technology, which allows them to be interrogated, as they call it, from an appliance which they often put by the bedside, and allows telemetry to be uploaded and then sent over the internet to a central database for analysis and for clinical alert purposes to be communicated back to physicians. So these little devices are actually quite sophisticated now. So implantable defibrillators, this is an interesting thing because of something called OptiVol, which I'll come to in a second, and pacemakers. You've heard of these things before, but OptiVol is an interesting thing. It actually measures transthoracic impedance, and so measures the amount of fluid that's building up in the lungs. Before the patient becomes symptomatic, the system will alert them that their fluid status is getting out of balance, and we can avoid an episode of congestive heart failure as a result of this kind of information. Now, the reason that this is so interesting, and also the pacemakers and implantable defibrillators keep track of rhythm disturbances as well, which is uploaded. Obviously, these are early warning systems that are now being built into these therapeutic devices. So all these devices are implanted for therapeutic reasons. They can help the patient to regulate their rhythm more closely. But the really interesting element of this is what happens when we start marketing devices that are purely diagnostic in function. So you could imagine a product that is not marketed today, but you could imagine a product that is just this. So everybody with congestive heart failure has one of these devices implanted, which allows us to monitor them constantly. And rather than having a $20,000 hospitalization in the ICU to clear out their lungs, that we could just phone them at home and say, you know, double your Lasix pill today, and that'll avoid you getting into trouble. And these are very real possibilities that are coming. Again, if you look at our EHR architectures, this type of stuff does not appear anywhere. And this is Medtronic gave me this information, which I very much appreciate. Looking at how many patients are now part of their CareLink network and are regularly uploading clinical telemetry to their data centers. There's one in Chicago and one in Europe. And you can see that they're almost at 250,000 people now regularly monitored through this approach. but when you look at the number of people, this is Canadian data now, that could benefit from these types of technologies, from this type of monitoring. You've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 people with congestive heart failure, somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 with rhythm disease. All of a sudden, you're talking about very large components of the population. And by the way, very large components of the population at most interest to us as practitioners, because these are the people that use the system more than average. I'm just going to keep moving through sort of disruptive forces. This is Brian Postel's report on wait times. There was a little piece in there that hasn't had a lot of attention. He talks about many industries and businesses using queuing theory and industrial practices to streamline their processes, and that this is rare in healthcare. We've not sufficiently exploited the academic resources available to us from business management schools or industrial engineering. And then he also talks about this concept of surge capacity to be able to essentially tie supply of services to demand more effectively to be able to get rid of wait lists. Well, I have very bad news for all of us in the healthcare system, and I'll try to back it up in a second. And the bad news is that the wait times that we have in our system are whatever we choose them to be. And many of our wait times, and I say this with some nervousness given that the wait time czar is in the audience, but many of the wait times that we have in our system are stable. They're not getting longer and they're not getting shorter. And basic sort of understanding of queuing theory tells you that our supply of services and the demand for those services is in perfect balance. If the wait list isn't changing in length, then we're in perfect balance. So then why do we maintain that long waiting list? I mean, there's no real reason to just maintain that long waiting list. It just stays stable like that for ages and ages. And it just shows that we don't really understand well some of these issues about queuing theory, industrial engineering, surge capacity, etc. And there's a really interesting article in Healthcare Policy just on this. Patrick and Putterman from BC looked at this, and they looked at scheduling algorithms and how we decide to schedule our patients. I encourage you to read the paper, but they talk about the complexity of doing scheduling when we've got patients categorized into priority classes with different service time targets, multiple equipment, different courses of treatment, with multiple events during that treatment, and resources spread across a wide geographic region. So who do we ask to come up with the scheduling algorithms for our healthcare system? We all know that the czars of scheduling are, in fact, the clerical people that answer the phones and the secretaries that do all the work. And they do this without any tools whatsoever. So we get what we get as a result of that design feature of the system. They put together a very simple sort of scheduling algorithm for ensuring that nobody exceeds the wait time target. You can read this. It's very simple. My slides will be available later if you want to dive into this in more detail. But this is the important point. Research shows that it's never advisable to book patients beyond their wait time target. Doing so does not avoid the need for overtime. Instead, it just delays when it's needed. Optimal scheduling policy remains optimal regardless of the number of priority classes, the specific wait time targets, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the gist of this is that we're not actually managing our resources very well. We try to schedule patients in a very static way. We decide that somebody is sort of slotted in for surgery in advance, and then we just sort of take what comes after that, and we make no effort to try to coordinate resource allocation across different parts of the system. So I was struck to think about, well, how does the airline industry do this? And there's a very interesting paper on dynamic airline scheduling that came out of MIT now almost 2 years ago. And just looking at how to do this, there were some really interesting points that came out in this paper. Demand forecast quality for a particular date improves as the date approaches. So I started looking at that, and I was thinking about my days as a, in hospital operations, and I was thinking, well, how much did I think about the demand that my organization or my department or my hospital was going to be facing 2 weeks out from where I was, or 4 weeks out, or 6 weeks out? In fact, as a COO, had no visibility at all as at an organizational level as to what kind of demand for services I would be facing at some point in the future. We have very little future orientation in healthcare because we've convinced ourselves that the emergency cases and that sort of thing make things entirely unpredictable. If you want to talk about unpredictability, airlines face this constantly with weather, as obviously a very big issue, and then equipment failures and that sort of thing. So, very interesting statistics looking at Air Canada and WestJet and their load factors. Now, load factor is the percentage of their seats that they fly that are filled with a living, breathing, and most importantly, paying passenger. And you can see that they've been setting records year after year after year, if you've been reading about what they've been doing. And it's because they've been doing very dynamic scheduling in advance and load balancing across the various parts of their system. This is a screen that I face on a weekly basis. So this is looking at Air Canada's, this is Air Canada's website and how they manage flights. This is Toronto to New York, and you can see the various sort of fare classes here. If you look across the top, you can find out which day has the lowest price, and then, of course, you can see sort of the price differences. Now, these are the same planes going between the same 2 points, and if you travel at 1:30 that day, you pay $3.39, and if you travel at 2:30, you pay $5.97. Now, you look at that, and you know your immediate reaction is, well, why would it be such a huge difference in price? You know, $250 difference between those, between 1 hour difference in flying time. Well, the obvious answer, of course, and then of course, God help you if you're waiting till 4:30. And the obvious answer is this is almost a full plane, right? They're selling the last couple of seats on that plane. This plane has lots of space left on it, okay? So what they're doing, they're not trying to give you a bargain in this website. What they're trying to do is they're trying to push the flexible people to the low-load airplanes and the people who are, you know, stuck because of meetings or schedules or that sort of thing, who are probably not very price sensitive, to go onto the more expensive planes. And they've been very effective at managing this and improving their load factors and their profitability. And both airlines have actually been quite profitable the last few years, despite record high oil prices, which is actually quite impressive. So their ability to do this, and by the way, this is completely dynamic. If you log into the same screen tomorrow, the prices will be different. Okay, and the day after and the day after. So this is real-time changes in their pricing based on their load predictions. But they also do other things. They will swap out equipment. Have you ever noticed that A lot of planes have business class that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then the first next seat is 12. Have you ever wondered why they skip those intervening seat numbers? And the reason that they do that is so that they can actually take out a small plane and put in a big plane, and everybody who's already been assigned a seat number, that seat number is still valid, but then there's other, so they don't have to renumber any of the seats. So the planes are standard to be able to swap in and out. So when was the last time that we planned for overtime in an operating room 2 weeks in advance? I mean, we don't do that. That is not something that, you know, oh, gee, we're expecting a surge in requirement for something. Rather than doing that kind of flexible allocation of resources, we let a waiting list sort of build up behind us. Okay? There's no need for that to happen. Now, yeah, this thing's running out of batteries too, so I may get stuck somewhere. I am on board time. Okay, so this is an example of real data, just to give you an example of beds occupied in an orthopedic unit over a period of weeks. It's hard to see the numbers at the bottom, showing the number of occupied beds, and showing that if you just allow the secretaries to schedule the ORs on an ad hoc basis, that you get the result on the left. And if you use an algorithm for scheduling those patients to try to minimize the fluctuation in requirements, you get the result on the right. You can see this is exactly the same patient volume and exactly the same length of stay for the cases. This is just changing the order in which the cases are done. Okay? You can see that you see the top red line there comes down significantly in terms of the total number of beds that one requires. It allows you to balance load over time. Now, given that I've gone way over my time and I've got two other things to talk about, I'm gonna have to leave you to look at the remainder of the slides. But let me just point out the two things that I wanted to talk about. One of them is that Joseph Durand died in February, who was the Six Sigma guru, and his institute estimated that 30% of all direct healthcare outlays are the result of poor quality care. Most people in the industry don't really believe this to be true. Even if it isn't 30%, it's a large number. I actually do believe it to be true. But the opportunities are huge, and we need to build our information systems to be able to do this. There's a few slides here on this issue, and I'm just going to skip through them. And I'll just end with a couple of concluding remarks. I think we're going to have to rethink our EHR agenda as a result of some of these new events that are starting to wash across the business. We have new entrants from the software perspective. We have new users being our patients with the PHRs. We have new players in the device manufacturers that are coming to the table and building big databases of clinical information. We have new needs, so the dynamic scheduling issue, and new industry developments. And I'm sorry that I wasn't able to talk about this definition of quality, but there's a couple of references in here that you might want to look at. In the end, this becomes a battle for users. Content is what attracts users to systems more than functionality. It's an important thing to remember. They come for the data as opposed to the fancy screens. And the other thing is that borders don't exist in this kind of game. And this is probably the type of force that'll start to globalize the health industry, because people will go where the quality leads them. So with that, let me stop, Anton. I'm sorry that I've gone a little bit over time, but okay.
We'll thank Michael with a donation going to Ryerson, where Michael's been very active and his father was active, and we thank Michael for coming. And Breakfast with the Chiefs will resume next September. Thank you for coming.
This has been Longwoods Radio. Thanks for listening.